you're listening on our public feed, which includes a shortened version of this episode. To hear the extended version and get access to our bonus shows, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com.
This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network, the home of great music podcasts. Visit us at fmpods.com.
You are listening to the Dilettantes Podcast.
Hey everyone, I'm Jim Salvucci of the Dilettantes, and welcome to the latest installment of Million Dollar Bash. It's that Million Dollar Bash. The Basement Tapes occupy a unique place of honor in the pantheon of Dylan legends, coming just after two other legendary events, the Going Electric performance and subsequent tour, and Dylan's motorcycle accident. The 1967 recordings were a collaboration between Bob Dylan and his previous backing group, who would soon after become the members of the band. The tracks they laid down, first in Dylan's house in Woodstock, New York, and then literally in the basement of the house dubbed Big Pink that three members of the band rented, were never meant for the public. They consist of covers of pop songs, folk numbers, and blues. In addition, they recorded a large number of Dylan originals, some apparently intended as demos for other musicians to record. Public interest in the sessions was piqued by the release of The Great White Wonder in 1969, widely regarded as the first rock bootleg. The album features five Dylan originals from the Basement Tapes. Given Dylan's minimal public presence at the time, this bootleg could not help but excite the fan base. In 1975, Columbia released an album entitled The Basement Tapes, which consisted of a number of these recordings, along with some demos from the band, who were still active and popular. It was inevitable that many more of these storied recordings would make their way into Dylan aficionados' collections as bootlegs, some of which purported to be complete. In truth, even 2014's The Bootleg Series Volume 11, The Basement Tapes Complete, is likely not all there is. And Dylan also penned many lyrics without any musical accompaniment during this period, some of which were set to music and released on the 2014 album, The New Basement Tapes, produced by T-Bone Burnett, and featuring luminaries such as Elvis Costello and Rihanna Giddens. Grail Marcus documented the circumstances and significance of these recordings in his 1997 book, Invisible Republic, updated in 2011 as The Old Weird America. Marcus' book squarely positions them in the American musical tradition. Today, we will address just the cover songs from the Basement Tapes. We hope next time, in a part two, to discuss the Dylan Penn numbers. So let me introduce our panel. First off, we have Rockin' Rob Virginio.
Hi, Jim. Hi, everyone else. Great to be back.
Gray Lee Hearn.
Hey, everybody. Looking forward to this one.
Court Carney.
Hello, everyone.
And Nina Goss.
Hello. Hi.
Thank you, everyone, for being here. We're hoping that Erin Callahan will make it a little bit later. And I decided to prepare one question in advance to open this discussion. Do you think the band would have ever become the band without the Basement Tape sessions? And why or why not?
It dovetails a little bit with the song that I want to talk about, but Robbie Robertson spoke a little bit about Dylan teaching them like Pete Seeger songs that he thought were hopelessly square and lame. And then because he said, we came into this on a whole other train, as he said, right? Ronnie Hawkins and really powerful driving R&B. And Dylan, at least in Robertson's telling, got him to see the old triangle and the Bells of Rimini and some of these songs to see the great emotive power in them. Does that mean that open their eyes to the possibilities of covering what we now call working in the tradition of what we now call roots music? I don't know, but there is certainly some suggestions in Robertson's comments that the train that they got off, the train they came in on, that R&B blazing Ronnie Hawkins train, and Dylan opened up a path for them.
Do you mean would the band have cohered into what led to the last waltz? We have the last waltz if it wasn't for the Basement Tapes. Is that what you mean?
So the band was an R&B rockabilly group, backing group. They were Bob Dylan's backing group. They were just doing driving rock, as Rock and Rob said. And they weren't doing Americana roots music at all, as far as I'm aware. And I'm wondering if this is the birth of that and the group that released the album, Music from Big Pink, that would have even existed but for this recording.
At the very least, they probably wouldn't have figured it out in West Saugerties, in a pink house, which they apparently only lived in to be close to Dylan. On the one hand, I respect the band so much, and I don't want in any way to belittle their achievements to suggest that they needed Bob Dylan to make it happen. They were already making something happen that the fans loved in Toronto for many years. But would they have had that quantum leap into Americana music? I tend to agree with Rob, probably not. And, you know, I don't know. I'd love to know what Dylan thought he was doing with the band, other than sneaking out of the house and away from the kid to have a drink, smoke some pot, and make some music. There's part of me that has always imagined it as a kind of seminar that Bob Dylan was intentionally teaching these largely Canadian musicians about American music. But I don't know if Dylan ever saw himself as a professor in that sort of way. If I had to pick one song that maybe captures what Rob was talking about for me this time through listening to the Basement Tapes, it would be the cover of My Bucket's Got a Hole in It by Hank Williams, right? Which starts off pretty straight as a kind of tongue-in-cheek country accent cover of Hank Williams. And then suddenly you get this scream that's straight out of the Beatles' Twist and Shout. And you realize, wow, you could do that with a Hank Williams song? That's not what I thought Hank Williams was. And I think that kind of exploding the shallow myths of square music is what Dylan did for the band. And then they took it from there and were just phenomenal. But I do feel like Dylan was probably the spark that ignited that to a large extent.
Yeah, I love that particular cover with that Beatles scream. I was listening to it in my car and that came on, and my wife's a big Beatles fan. I said, see, there you go, Bob Dylan doing the Beatles, right? It's pretty wonderful. Court, do you have something to say about this question?
I wonder, bringing in the Beatles, it's like you could wonder if this is like their Hamburg, right? Not in terms of playing, because that was the Toronto club scene for them, or the Canadian club scene for them. But in terms of every day or most days, they're just learning new songs they didn't really seem to know. And I love that line too, where they're like, is it Garth or someone? They probably all at one point that they never knew if it was like an original or if it was something that Bob wrote or if this is an old song or whatever. And I think that it was like a boot camp of sorts. I mean, in a very fun way of them constantly learning these songs and constantly playing these songs. And I love on some of the songs too, you can tell they don't know them, obviously. In the middle, there's one song where Robbie's soloing and then the band's like he's waiting for the band to catch up. And you don't know if he knows the changes or if they don't know the changes. It's a really lovely mix of stuff. But I do think that there is something that they could play, obviously, and they'd played with him, but this was different. And I think what Grayley said too is he wasn't a professor. It wasn't like a chalkboard thing, but they were clearly confronting songs and music in a way that they hadn't before. And I think that probably does lead them in a very different path than they would have. Would they have been the band? Maybe, but would they have been what the band became? I think the Basement Tapes are very important. I think it was very important to them in a way that maybe is less important to Dylan and Dylan's world. I think you could probably make the argument there too. But yeah, I think it's interesting. The way to say that in another way is like, are the Basement Tapes when they come out, this is the anniversary, right? When they come out, the band's Columbia Records version of the Basement Tapes. Is that more of a band story than a Dylan story? Or is the band more invested in that project than Dylan? I don't know. It's interesting.
That's a really great point, because there's so many band-only songs on that set. Yeah, absolutely.
And clearly, the bootleg complete, the official release, volume 11, has none of the band only pieces. And I never heard a bootleg. I used to listen to A Tree with Roots, and I know there's several others, and I've checked them out. I don't remember any that had any of the band only songs. So I don't know what else they did. And those songs that are on the 1975 release, The Basement Tapes, I don't think any of those were actually recorded during the Basement Tape sessions. I think they were all demos that the band did for other things with varying results, not some of their best work. It's an odd collection, to say the very least. The Dylan stuff's interesting, but the band stuff is, in some cases, a very bizarre selection.
I think, Jim, what you just brought up is what I, what my one note card of comments was about. But I think it was so interesting to go back to Tree with Roots, which I'm assuming, I don't want to speak for everybody, but that was such an important collection. And I remember when I first got that bootleg, those CDs, it was like, I had heard about this record for so long. I heard about these songs for so long. And you had read about them. Marcus writes an entire book about material that most readers hadn't heard. And it was like this mystery. And then to hear those songs, it was like, this is the greatest thing in the world. And I think it's so important. And then when it comes out, when it becomes the actual bootleg series, it's so eye-opening in terms of the fidelity of some of the material we have now and that kind of stuff. But it's that collection, I don't think, can be overstated in terms of how important it was in terms of opening my eyes to what could be the possibility of the Basement Tape. They weren't just a few songs that became other bigger songs. There was dozens of songs that were just on their own level, just so beautiful and wonderful.
So what about the covers? Gord, I know you have a note card that you keep holding up defensively.
Is there anything written on there? I can defer to others. I will say this, though. I love the clutch of Johnny Cash songs because he's got Big River and he's got Still in Town, which is a lesser known one, and those old kind of Sun Records songs. But they're not that old. That's what's so funny about, like, Big River is not even a decade old when he's doing it. You think he's pulling out, it's like the Beatles and Let It Be. You think they're pulling out these ancient songs from 7 years. One after 909. How'd they remember that from seven Dave Barry calendar pages? But I do think that those songs are really beautiful. And I think that he digs into them. And I know that there's a lot of things we can say with a couple of these songs that they're still in rotation today. Big River, he played on the last tour. I think it's really, I don't want to belabor the point that I always make about history, that kind of stuff. But I will say this, I think it's really interesting to hear how great those songs sound. I forgot to remember to forget, this sounds really great. Big River sounds wonderful, but these are not also ancient. Some of them are Old Triangle, all that kind of stuff. Doug, get into the, but some of these songs are from a few years prior, but he's playing them as if they're like ancient songs.
I've got a big picture observation. I'm sure we'll want to dig into some of the specific cover songs along the way, but I so love that it took place in a basement. Let's start there. That it's almost too perfect that it takes place in a basement because it lends itself so well to the sense of underground music, underground art, right? But also to these other themes I love in Bob Dylan of descent, right? Descent into an underworld, descent inward into the cell. And when you descend into this album, I'm especially thinking of the bootleg series version, 6 discs long, you can just play it all day. It feels like you're descending into the mind of Bob Dylan. It feels like this is probably what it sounds like in his head all the time, right? This kind of buzzing swarm of bees, of snatches of music and different genres and different registers and different moods and different eras. And somehow, miraculously, this got pulled out of his brain and his mouth and his fingertips and communicated to a band of other people who are hungry to consume it. And they just jam. And sometimes it works and sometimes it laughably doesn't. But most of the time it works. And the sonic atmosphere, the mindscape, it feels like you've entered into. It feels like such a privilege, right? That you're getting the inside story of what it sounds like in Bob Dylan's head. This is what I think of when I'm thinking of Basement Tapes, not individual tracks, but just listening to one after another, as I had the privilege to do preparing for this. this conversation, and it's just phenomenal.
That's what I always think when I get near the basement tapes, is it's so overdetermined. It's such a piece of theater that he's constructed. Everything about it from the outside is so artificial and overdetermined. The basement and the costumes that he wears and the way he uses his, for the first and only time in his life, he uses his family as props to create this entire theater of retreat and authenticity, and everything about it should be so fake. And then he opens his mouth and you're gone. And that's why I'm not a musicologist. I can't tell if the band is good, very good, or excellent, or on any spectrum. And I don't even hear them. Sometimes I hear Robbie Robertson's guitar, but otherwise he opens his mouth and you get the Bells of Rimini, and then you get Be My Baby. How is this the same throat and brain creating these two experiences? And then all the theatricality seems essential to the transcendent moments of the individual song.
You're talking about those Elliot Landy photograph, Nina?
Yeah,
where you, yeah, that's a really great, you never thought about that before, how using his family as props, as you said, never. That's, he keeps that big wall around his family and his private life in here. But I think I agree with you that it's a kind, he's posing.
He can afford to buy a whole Truman Show for himself. He can really, and he can afford the assistants to create this with him. And we get the Bells of Rimini and Big River and, oh, that sad song about the mule. Cool Water. I can't listen to that too often. It's so sad, but there you go.
Yeah, Johnny Cash recorded that in one of his late life American recordings. I don't remember if that one was released. I think that one was released posthumously. That's where I first encountered that, I think.
And Belshazzar is a Johnny Cash song, right?
Yeah.
Pronounces it strangely. Yes.
Belshazzar, yeah.
Yes. Belshazzar, yeah. Where's that from?
But if we're moving into individual songs that we love, and I've listened to basement tapes almost exclusively for a month ever since I knew that we were doing it, except for the last week when I've been listening to Guided by Voices, because I so loved Court Carney's piece on the 30th anniversary of B-1000. And if you haven't read that, go out and read it. Subscribe to his Substack. But aside from a week of Guided by Voices, it was all basement tapes. And because it's so long, you just often have it on in the background, right? It becomes this mental wallpaper and you're appreciating it, but maybe not totally zoned in. But the song, there's more than one, but the one that really struck me that always just makes me snap to attention is Mr. Blue. Now he's bringing it back apparently on the current tour. That's crazy. But that performance of Mr. Blue is so arrestingly beautiful. And it is such a serenade and a seduction, and it works. I fall in love with this man every time he plays that song. And I mean, he just knows all my buttons to push with Mr. Blue. It is so achingly gorgeous. And Nina was saying earlier, it's unfathomable that the same guy that we know, think we know so well from the Electric Tour in 1966 and all of the footage there, how can that guy be the guy just months later who's performing Mr. Blue? It's some kind of, I don't know, transubstantiation he's done, but I'm buying it. Everything he's selling, I'm buying that song, Mr. Blue. Oh, love it.
Usually it's Spanish is the loving tongue that I've noticed get turn men into Bob Dylan, make men briefly, whatever.
Yeah, and I'm totally crushing on him there.
Yeah, Nina. Crushing on. Yeah, Spanish is a loving tongue, is the, but that we can.
not
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for here in the public feed. If you'd like to hear the rest of this episode and get access to extended and bonus episodes from this and all of the other shows on the network, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com.
Thank you for listening to the Dilettantes Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to FM Pods to hear the complete podcast.